Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Members of the jury, I want to confirm while you're away, you did not discuss this case amongst yourselves. You did not do any investigation and you received no information. Is that correct?
Correct.
And no one approached you about this case. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you've not seen any media accounts about this case. Is that correct?
Correct.
And Mr. Shapiro.
Sure, thank you. You called Dr. Sharon Levy.
Okay, and members of the jury, you see Dr. Levy via Zoom on the screen in front of you. I just want to let you know, outside of your presence, I did administer the oath to her, and so she is testifying under oath. Mr. Shapiro, you may inquire.
Sure, thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Dr. Levy. Will you please introduce yourself to the jury?
Yes, my name is Sharon Levy. I am a pediatrician and an addiction medicine specialist, and I practice at Boston Children's Hospital in Massachusetts.
Okay, let me walk you through a little bit about that. What's your current title at Boston Children's?
I am the chief of the Division of Addiction Medicine at Boston Children's Hospital.
Okay, so let's go backwards a little bit. Where did you get your undergraduate degree?
At the University of Pennsylvania.
And what did you graduate with?
I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree.
And what did you do for education after your BA from University of Pennsylvania?
I went to medical school at New York University.
Okay. And what year did you graduate from NYU?
1992.
And did you do any internship training after that?
I did. I did an internship, a residency, and a chief residency in pediatrics at Bellevue Hospital, NYU Medical Center.
And what does that mean to be chief resident?
In pediatrics, chief resident is an honorary position. It's a fourth year. So it's an extra year of residency training where you become responsible for overseeing your fellow residents, your more junior residents.
Did you do any fellowship training after your internship and residency?
I did. At Boston Children's Hospital, I did what was called a pediatric advocacy training fellowship, which really was equivalent to, I think in many ways, what we would call a developmental behavioral pediatric fellowship today.
And do you hold any board certifications?
I do. I am board certified in developmental behavioral pediatrics and also in addiction medicine.
Do you also hold a master's degree?
I have a master's degree in public health from the Harvard School of Public Health.
And what's your current title? Well, let me back up for a minute. When you were doing your training at Boston Children's, is that affiliated with Harvard Medical School?
Yes, that is one of the hospitals affiliated with Harvard Medical School.
What's your current title at Boston Children's?
So I am the chief of the Division of Addiction Medicine at Boston Children's Hospital.
Okay. Is that a unique position in terms of its affiliation with the hospital?
It is. So the Division of Addiction Medicine was created in the Department of Pediatrics at Boston Children's Hospital just this past July. Before that, we had been a program within a, in a larger division. We are the first Division of Addiction Medicine at a pediatric hospital in the United States.
Have you contributed any publications to the medical literature?
I have.
Okay. Do you have a rough count of how many, approximately?
I would say well over 100.
Okay. And what does it mean to have peer-reviewed literature?
So peer-review literature means that the journal has sent out a manuscript to have it reviewed by people who are experts in the field. Typically, they will give comments and suggestions, and often manuscripts are revised based on having some outside expert look at it prior to publication.
And have you contributed any topics to any textbooks?
I believe... Without looking, without doing a formal count, I believe I've written more than 20 or 30 textbook chapters, and I also serve as an associate editor of the Principles of Addiction Medicine, which is the core textbook for the field of addiction medicine.
And you mentioned to me about a special recognition from the White House recently. What was that about?
Yes, a number of years ago, I was recognized by the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy for contributions to the field of addiction medicine around developing the field of pediatric addiction medicine.
So in this case, I sent you some medical records and some documents to review. Have you reviewed them in preparation for your testimony?
I have.
And do you have a rough account of how much you've billed or will bill to this point?
So going back to 2019, when I first started looking at this case, the total has been roughly about $10,000 for the past 4 years or so.
So let me ask you about some of your opinions. Are you familiar with the drug ketamine?
I am.
Is ketamine addictive?
Yes. Ketamine is a psychoactive drug that is addictive.
Okay. When you say psychoactive drug, what do you mean by that?
So a psychoactive drug, I'm referring to any drug that can cause release of dopamine in the brain's pleasure and reward center. So any drug that can do that will have the potential to be addictive.
When we use the word addiction, can you explain to the jury, what does that mean when you say something's addictive?
Yeah, so actually, a little bit of background here, if I may. The technical diagnoses we use in the field of addiction medicine are actually substance use disorder. So this is a diagnosis that's made by a checklist of 11 items that really speak to trouble controlling use, having use of a substance interfere with day-to-day functioning or interpersonal relationships, or substance use that's dangerous. So there are 11 criteria. We ask patients who come in when we're evaluating them for substance use disorder. We take a history and see if they've met these criteria, and that's how we make a formal diagnosis of a substance use disorder. The term addiction is not precisely defined. Generally speaking, people use it to mean loss of control over substance use. I think many people may have may know of people who have become addicted to nicotine, who will do things to continue to use nicotine even if the nicotine use, for example, isn't pleasurable. So the issue around addiction is that it can really change someone's behavior. And so I think, you know, and some people might think of, when they hear addiction, some people might think of the clinical picture of somebody who's addicted to heroin, who might really do some, who in order to obtain or use heroin might really do some things that are really not typical behavior. For example, you know, they might, you know, rob or steal to get money to buy heroin or to get the drug itself. Sometimes it's a much more subtle thing. Again, like someone who's become addicted to nicotine might, you know, stand out in the middle of a snowstorm to smoke because they're not allowed to smoke indoors, right? So it's loss of control over behavior, sometimes with really, you know, kind of fulminant changes in behavior. I would like to say, though.
Objection, Your Honor. Narrative.
Okay.
Sustained.
Yeah. So let me ask you about, in terms of ketamine's addictive properties, can you describe to the jury what those would be? Why would ketamine be addictive?
So all substances that can cause release of dopamine in the brain can be addictive. So it turns out that changes in the neurons of the part of the brain that's called the pleasure and reward center can actually result in the clinical picture that we call addiction, right? So what's happening in those cases is that substance use is kind of being, you know, for lack of a better word, it's being misfiled by the brain. And it's now being put into the category of life-sustaining behaviors, which would include things like breathing and eating and drinking. When that happens, the subconscious parts of the brain start to protect the behavior. So when you're
let me ask you about that. When you say the subconscious part of the brain protect behavior, what are you referring to, doctor?
Yeah, thank you. So if you try and hold your breath for too long, at some point your reflexes in your brain will take over and you'll start breathing again, right? Because for life-sustaining behaviors, your brain is going to go, it is going to make sure that those behaviors don't get interrupted. The same, when you become addicted to a substance, your brain starts protecting that substance use, the more primitive parts of your brain will take over from the higher order parts of your brain that normally control behavior to ensure that you get to substance use if needed.
Is there a particular risk of addiction in the immature brain versus the mature brain?
There is. So the part of the brain called the prefrontal cortexes, that's the part of the brain that houses what we call executive functions. Those are things like impulse control, error monitoring. That part of the brain is developing in adolescence through early adulthood, and that process in most people is thought to conclude somewhere around age 25, so in the mid-20s. While that part of the brain is still maturing, it turns out that part of the brain can protect against some of the changes in the pleasure and reward center that are associated with this loss of control or the clinical picture of addiction. Once those parts of the brain, the prefrontal cortexes, are mature in adults, they provide some protection against the changes that we see in addiction. So in younger people, while that part of the brain is still maturing, they are more susceptible to developing addiction. And in fact, for every substance that we look at, we know that the younger you are when you start using a substance, the greater your chance of developing a substance use disorder. That's been shown for alcohol, cannabis, opioids, other substances.
So in terms of the actual physiologic effect, Are you able to tell the jury whether ketamine can cause problems such as cell death in the brain?
Yes. So ketamine can cause apoptosis, particularly in younger animals. So apoptosis is programmed cell death, and ketamine accelerates that process.
In terms of both short-term and long-term, let's talk about short-term. Are you able to educate the jury about what the short-term effects are of ketamine use?
So short-term effects typically include psychotic symptoms, things like delusions, hallucinations, or out-of-body experiences. Can also include memory impairment on a physiologic level. Ketamine can increase heart rate and slow respiration.
Why does ketamine cause memory impairment?
So ketamine is a blocker of a receptor in the brain that's called NMDA. When that receptor is blocked, get all kinds of physiological consequences secondarily, and memory loss is one of them.
Does ketamine cause respiratory depression?
Yes, ketamine slows respiration.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about longer term, more chronic use of ketamine. Can you educate the jury of what some of the risks are of long-term ketamine use?
Yes. So people who use ketamine in the long term can develop problems with cognition, problems with memory, psychotic disorders, and mood disorders.
Clay, are you able to put up Exhibit 1046-004? And doctor, I don't know if you'll be able to see this, but I'll ask you, I provided you with a copy of Dr. Lewis's report. One moment. Did you see, they're pulling it up real quickly here. On the second full paragraph, it says, thus the presence of processing speed deficits are likely occurring as a result of at least two etiologies. Dr. Lewis talks about psychomotor slowing. Is that something that can be a known effect of ketamine?
Objection. One expert commenting on another's.
Overruled,
please. So, yes, that can be a consequence of ketamine use, ketamine exposure.
And you talked about mood disorder. What's the link between long-term ketamine use and mood disturbance?
So people who use ketamine chronically are more likely to have mood disorders that can include depression and bipolar disorder.
Clay, you can take that down now if you don't mind. So let me talk to you a little bit about, are you familiar? Could you educate the jury as to what withdrawal symptoms of ketamine would look like?
Yes. So there's no real described ketamine withdrawal constellation of symptoms, but what has been described are reactions of anxiety and intense irritability.
In terms of ketamine being a dissociative drug, are there any specific risks of a patient taking a dissociative drug long term?
Objection. Too vague as to long term.
So let me specify my question to you, Dr. Lee. Have you been provided the records that have generally shown the doses of ketamine that Maya received from 2015 until her hospitalization in All Children's in October of 2016?
Yes, I have.
In your review and your understanding based on your education, training, and experiences, would you consider those doses of ketamine to be high?
Yes, I would.
Go ahead. You can answer, Doctor.
Yes, I would. The doses that I've seen reported, in my opinion, are more similar to the kinds of exposures we see in people with ketamine addiction than we are than the lower doses that you would see when people use ketamine for analgesia or pain control.
Okay. Can somebody develop? Well, I won't say somebody, but is there a can a person develop a tolerance to ketamine based on chronic exposure?
Injection foundation.
Overruled.
You can answer, Doctor.
Yes. Tolerance is known to be associated with chronic ketamine use.
There's also some reference in the record of Maya receiving what's called a benzodiazepine. Are you familiar with those classes of drugs?
Yes.
And what are benzodiazepines?
Oh, benzodiazepines are sedatives that are used to control anxiety, and they're also anticonvulsants, and they're also used, they're also addictive.
And I was going to ask you that question. Is there a risk of addiction with long-term use of benzodiazepines?
Yes, there is.
Okay. And are you familiar with the withdrawal symptoms of benzodiazepines?
Yes, I am.
And what do those symptoms look like?
In benzodiazepines, we often see people experience anxiety, irritability, and they can have seizures from benzodiazepine withdrawal. Can actually be quite dangerous.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about use of ketamine going forward. The jury has heard a recommendation that Maya receive ketamine again based on a recommendation from Dr. Kirkpatrick for a certain period of time into the future. Let me ask you this. Based on your training and experience, would you consider it to be dangerous for an adolescent like Maya to be chronically using ketamine in the future?
Yes, I would.
Okay, and why?
Well, ketamine is an addictive substance. Maya's already had a very extensive exposure. I would be concerned that any chronic problems that she may be experiencing related to ketamine use could get worse. I would also be concerned that she could develop or worsen a substance use disorder to ketamine.
And is there a particular concern about starting a significant ketamine dose around her age at age 18 during that adolescent period that would be unique to that period of life?
Yes, there is. Again, you know, the risk of developing a substance use disorder is much higher among adolescents and young adults. I think that there would be real concerns about using a drug like ketamine, certainly in high doses, in somebody in this age range.
Okay. I appreciate your time, Doctor. Those are the questions I have at this point. I may have some after plaintiff's counsel asks you questions. Thank you.
Mr. Whitney.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Dr. Levy.
Good afternoon.
You've been paid $20,000 approximately today, is that right?
No. It's approximately $10,000 for my work on this case, dating back to 2019.
What do you charge per hour?
I have to double check my records, but I believe it's about $450 per hour.
So at that rate, you've spent approximately 20 hours looking at that case, this case over the previous 4 years. Is that right?
That sounds about right.
That's it, right?
Yes.
Certainly you haven't reviewed all of Maya's medical records.
I've reviewed quite a bit of her medical records, but I probably not every page that's ever been written.
Her chart at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital for the relevant admission is 3,700 pages. You didn't review that in 20 hours, did you?
No, I didn't review 3,000 pages.
In total? You haven't reviewed even 3,000 pages, have you?
I would have to go in and count how many pages. I would say that in medical records, often many of the pages don't take a lot of time to review.
So you did or did not review 3,700 pages from the relevant admission?
I would have to go back and look at my notes to tell you exactly how many pages that I've reviewed.
You might have reviewed 3,700 pages in 20 hours. Is that what you're telling the jury?
I think that it's possible simply because many of the pages in medical records are not dense writing, that are just more charts and things that can be reviewed very quickly.
So just taking that alone, that's 200 pages an hour. It's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kirkpatrick's records, how long are those?
How long are Dr. Kirkpatrick's records?
Right.
I really don't know off the top of my head.
Do you know who Dr. Kirkpatrick is?
I do.
Who's Dr. Kirkpatrick?
So he is a pain specialist who was an expert in treating chronic regional pain syndrome, who I believe consulted with Maya at some point. And I believe that he submitted a report on this case.
At what point did he consult with Maya?
I don't actually recall the exact dates on that.
How about Dr. Cantu? Have you reviewed his records?
Objection.
Overruled.
I believe that I've seen summaries of his records. I believe Dr. Cantu was a physician in Mexico who put Maya in a medical coma using ketamine. And I believe that I reviewed a summary of those records. I don't believe that I have every single record from that visit.
Do you have that summary of records with you today?
I would have to look through my files to see what I have.
Who provided you a summary of records? Dr. Cantu?
No, Dr. Cantu has not provided me a summary of records.
Defense counsel?
Yes. I don't believe they came from Dr. Cantu. I believe that I've read in the medical records about this previous admission.
When did Dr. Cantu see Maya?
If you're asking for the exact date, I believe it was somewhere in 2015, but I couldn't tell you for sure. I'd have to go back and look.
February of 2015, sound right?
That could be right.
Or it could be December.
Sorry, I don't recall the month or the exact year.
How about Dr. Hanna? Have you reviewed his records?
So again, I have reviewed some of the materials from Dr. Hanna. I think many of those materials may have been summarized in other notes from that I have read.
Other notes from who?
I think that there may have been notes referring to Dr. Hanna and his care in Maya's medical, in other parts of Maya's medical records.
But his notes specifically, have you reviewed those?
I think that I may have seen summaries of things like the amount of medications delivered and things like that, but not the detailed notes, no.
Who wrote the summary?
I believe it was Dr. Hanna.
Dr. Hanna wrote a summary.
I believe so.
Well, we haven't seen that and the jury hasn't seen that, so I'd just like to know if you have a summary from Dr. Hanna.
So I have a summary of the amount of medications that he administered, and it may have been produced by somebody else who was going through the notes and summarizing it.
Right. My question, doctor, is who authored the summary of Dr. Hanna's treatments?
I'm not sure, sir.
All right. What dosing did Dr. Kirkpatrick provide Maya Kowalski during her infusions?
Sorry, but you're asking me a lot of details that, you know, I would need to go back and look at notes. I have not committed these.
Well, to be fair, ma'am, you're being paid $450 an hour, so I am asking you details, and this is an important case. Can you tell me what dosing Dr. Kirkpatrick provided?
I would have to go and look that up.
How about Dr. Cantu, his dosing?
I would have to look up the exact doses.
You testified to this jury that there were high doses of ketamine, but you can't tell us what the doses were?
That's correct.
Wouldn't you need to know the doses to say whether they're low, high, extreme, negligible? To describe them in any way, you'd need to know the dosing, wouldn't you?
That's right. And
Dr. Hanna, what was Dr. Hanna's dosing?
Hold on. Can you please finish your answer?
Sure, please.
That's right. And I had looked at the doses and found them to be high. I've been looking at materials since 2019, so I can't remember all the details in my head.
You've been spending 5 hours a year in total since 2019, if we average out your 20 hours in this case, right?
That's correct.
It's not much. Well, that's not much, is it? Are you finished? I don't want to interrupt you. Are you finished with that answer?
Yes.
Okay. What are you being paid to be here today by Zoom?
$450 an hour.
Nothing wrong with being paid by the hour, right?
I'm sorry, is that a question?
There's nothing wrong conceptually with being paid by the hour, is there?
I don't think so.
Okay. Let's talk about your testimony specifically as it relates to Maya Kowalski, if there was any. 100-plus publications, none of those deal with ketamine, do they?
So the... So I often write about substance use and addictions, and often that is not specific to a substance. But if you're asking, do I have any articles that specifically review ketamine, I would say no.
Right. And your 20 to 30 textbook chapters, none specifically on ketamine, correct?
That's not correct. Actually, in the main adolescent medicine textbook called the Einstein Textbook of Adolescent Medicine, did co-author the chapter on substances of on psychoactive substances, which includes ketamine.
So maybe one textbook chapter that touches on ketamine.
So I would say one textbook chapter that reviews ketamine specifically. It also in the Principles of Addiction Medicine textbook was the associate editor for the section on withdrawal management, which included ketamine.
All right, let's turn to your testimony about some drugs having the potential for addiction. That was your testimony, right?
I don't think I used exactly those words, but that's an okay interpretation of it, yes.
And so, for example, nicotine, caffeine, those have potential for addiction.
Nicotine, certainly. Caffeine, I think that there's not clarity on that.
But you need to show with any potentially addictive drug that it actually caused addiction in a person, a patient, a user, however you want to describe them, right?
I'm not clear on the question. Could you please restate it?
It's not enough to just come in here and say to this jury, ketamine can be addictive, right? You need to connect it with what we're talking about here, which is Maya Kowalski, that she was addicted to ketamine.
Is that exactly the question for me? Is it?
You've never taken a history of Maya Kowalski, have you?
I have not.
You've never met Maya Kowalski?
I have not.
You've never interviewed Jack Kowalski about his daughter's treatments?
That's correct. I have not.
You've never spoken with Dr. Kirkpatrick?
Correct.
You've never spoken with Dr. Hannah?
That is correct.
You've never spoken with the primary care physician, Dr. Wassenaar?
That's correct.
You've never spoken with any of the mental health counselors that treated Maya Kowalski over this 2 years that we're talking about in this courtroom?
That's correct.
So it's solely a review of records, but you testified to make a diagnosis of substance abuse disorder or substance-related addictive disorder that you would need to take a history, right?
That's correct.
So you're not here testifying that you haven't reached a diagnosis of Maya Kowalski, are you?
I am not.
If we turn to, I believe when you said there are 11 criteria that you'd look to, tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe you were referencing the DSM-5.
Correct. There's an updated version, the DSM-5 TR.
And, yes. And the jury's heard about the updated TR version. I have in front of me the DSM-5, not TR. So if you tell me that there's some change in the TR relevant to what I'm about to ask you over the next few minutes, please let me know. Okay. For the substance-related addictive disorders in the DSM-5, these encompass 10 separate classes of drugs. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
You can admit that none of those are ketamine, right?
No, I disagree with that.
All right. Let's talk about them. 10 classes of drugs. Stop me when you hear the one that's ketamine. Alcohol, caffeine, cannabis, inhalants, opioids, sedatives, hypnotics, and anxiolytics. Tell me if that's ketamine. Stimulants, including cocaine, tobacco. Did you happen to hear ketamine?
So it would fit into different classes.
Mm. Which class?
Well, ketamine is, it's classified as a dissociative anesthetic, so it's in the hallucinogen class, and these are addictive. These are considered addictive medications, addictive substances.
One moment while I find the hallucinogen class, please. Hallucinogen. Now, you testified earlier that there was a checklist of 11 items that you use to look for this substance abuse disorder, right?
That's correct. It's substance use disorder, yes.
Substance use disorder. But if I look at the hallucinogen section, it turns out you're not testifying about the hallucinogen section because there are not 11 under that classification, are there?
I believe there are.
Let's talk about some of them. Now, underneath hallucinogen-related disorders, you have phencyclidine use disorder and you have other hallucinogen use disorder, and then you have phencyclidine intoxication and other hallucinogen intoxication. Which of these should we look to for your ketamine testimony here?
Ketamine is an analog of phencyclidine, so I mean, it would be under other.
Other hallucinogen use disorder?
Yes.
All right. Let's look at the criteria. A great deal of time is spent in activities necessary to obtain the hallucinogen. Can you point to any record that you've reviewed that showed Maya Kowalski spent a great deal of time in activities necessary to obtain ketamine?
So, you know, here I would say that I would not make a diagnosis without speaking to patient directly. So I don't really think a record review would be sufficient to make a diagnosis here.
Mm-hmm. All right, ma'am. Have you had a chance to review the dates of the ketamine infusions? Do we have a way to screen share this with her? Yes.
Yep.
I'm going to show you a calendar of Maya Kowalski's ketamine treatments, doctor. First of all, while we're pulling that up, in 2016, when was Maya's use of ketamine most frequent? Which month?
Sir, I wouldn't be able to tell you months.
How many infusions did she receive in 2016?
I would have to go back to records to look at that. I don't know off the top of my head.
Can you see the calendar, ma'am?
Yes.
All right. I'll represent to you that in red are days where Maya did not receive any ketamine. In green are days that she did receive ketamine.
Objection, mischaracterization.
Overall.
Let's look at May. See three infusions in May?
Yes.
And the last infusion in May was on the 13th, and she didn't receive her next infusion until June 1st. Do you see that?
Yes, I do.
Would you point me to any medical record spanning May 14th to May 31st where you noted symptoms of withdrawal or ketamine addiction?
That's not something that I'd be able to do. You're asking very detailed questions, but I think the question is whether some of the symptoms that are described in the medical records could have possibly been attributable to ketamine withdrawal.
And that's what I'm asking you. That's what I'm asking you. In May, what symptoms did you note in the medical records that you can attribute to ketamine use disorder, or more specifically, other hallucinogen use disorder that you're testifying to here?
So I would say that there are many times in the medical records where...
My question's about May, ma'am.
Well, she can finish her answer, please.
Can you answer Mr. Whitney's question, please?
There are many places in the medical records where people are describing what I think you could summarizes irritable behavior on Maya's behalf. I can't tell you exactly what happened in May. I don't have her medical records.
So some irritability in the medical records. All right.
Actually, it's not some irritability. I mean, it's actually extreme irritability as reported in those records.
Drugs that may actually cause addiction would include, I hope you'll agree with me, Toradol?
Yes.
Oxycodone?
Yes.
A lot of people hear about oxy addiction, right? Valium?
Yes.
Clonidine?
Clonidine is not really thought to be addictive.
All right. So if it turns out that after Dr. Kirkpatrick and Dr. Cantu and Dr. Hanna became involved, they were able to take Maya off of all these other addictive medications, that would be a benefit to the child, would it not?
I think that weaning a patient off of opioids and benzodiazepines can be a benefit, but not necessarily if it's being replaced by something else that can also be dangerous.
Can I see the attorneys for just a moment, please? Minutes. Do not discuss this case amongst yourselves. Do not do any investigation and receive no information. I'm unmuting the microphone to Dr. Levy. Dr. Levy, can you unmute yourself, please, at this point? Dr. Levy, do you have your Outlook open right now?
I think I do. I'm happy to close.
Well, first
that.
Off, I need you to close it out. And yeah. Have you been looking at it during this testimony?
I have not seen it during this testimony.
Do any of the lawyers wish to ask any questions on this issue?
No, no.
Okay, you can't have anything other than the Zoom open, ma'am. So please.
My apologies.
Okay, please close that. Anything else before I bring the jury back in?
No,
bring in the jury. Okay, please be seated. Members of the jury, I want to confirm you did not discuss this case amongst yourselves. You did no investigation and received no information. Is that all correct?
Correct.
And you did not see any media in the 2 minutes you were gone?
No.
And no one approached you in those 2 minutes?
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Whitney, you can continue.
Thank you. Dr. Levy, did it come to your attention that the drugs we were just discussing, Toradol, Oxycodone, Valium, and Clonidine, were all prescribed and administered to Maya Kowalski in 2015?
Yes.
Simultaneously?
Yes.
At Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital?
Yes. I don't remember the details, but it doesn't sound.
I want to ask you about, you mentioned Dr. Lewis's report. What drugs was Maya Kowalski on when she underwent Dr. Lewis's neurological, psychological evaluation?
I don't believe that she was on any medications at that time.
You're not positive of that, are you?
Well, I think that there's a note at the beginning that said that she had a what's known as a PRN order that she could ask for. I believe it was an opioid, but she hadn't asked for it that day. So the examiner thought there were no substances in her system.
But you haven't cross-checked that statement against the medication administration records of the hospital and the nurses, have you? Because those show there were drugs given to her that day.
Objection, mm-hmm. Mischaracterization of the record.
It's in evidence.
It's in the
overall.
Yeah. You haven't seen that, have you?
No, I have not.
And one of the markers of a use disorder would be the need. First of all, you would exhaust your supply, would you not? That's what forces you to seek frequent and early refills or prescriptions or obtain them illicitly or whatever you're going to do, right?
Well, that often happens, but exhausting one's supply is not one of the criteria.
You'd expect that if someone had a use disorder as described in the DSM-5, that they would go through their existing supply, would you not?
Objection asked and answered.
Sustained.
Have you ever reviewed the District 12 Medical Examiner's inventory of medications found in the Kowalski home in Objection. January 2017?
Approach.
Dr. Levy, if you can open your microphone again, please. Thank you.
And the objection is?
Is overruled.
Thank you. You're not aware, doctor, that the Kowalskis received a prescription for oxycodone in November of 2014. 15 tablets were prescribed, and as of January 2017, 13 remained in their home. Are you?
I was not aware.
They used two over the course of 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
No further questions at this time.
Mr. Shapiro.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Levy, Clay, can you put up what's in evidence as 1046-003? And Dr. Levy, I'm showing you Dr. Lewis's report that you were asked about. This is at the very top. It's above, yeah, there you go. Can you blow up that first paragraph? It says the absence of any, can you read that? Are you able to see that?
Yes.
Go ahead and read that paragraph and then I'll ask you a question.
Yes.
Okay. So was that what you were referring to Mr. Whitney, that when you read Dr. Lewis's report, Maya was not on any analgesic pain medication during that assessment? Is that what you were referring to?
Yes, it was.
Okay. So let's go backwards a little bit. You were asked about Dr. Cantu's records and whether you've reviewed them. I'll represent to you he doesn't have any records. Is that why you didn't review them?
Objection, misstates his lab records and evidence.
Dr. Cantu does not have his records from the ketamine coma. That's why you haven't seen them, right?
Yes.
So let me ask you about ketamine dosage. And by the way, you were shown this ketamine dosage chart. Anywhere in that chart did it show the ketamine that Maya was drinking at home?
It did not.
Those were just infusions. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you are aware that Beata Kowalski was also having Maya drink ketamine in between. Is that right?
Objection as phrased.
Overall.
Yes, I had read that in the medical records.
Are you generally familiar with the standard dosing of sub-anesthetic ketamine in terms of milligrams per kilograms per hour?
Yes.
Is that between 0.1-0.5 milligrams? Okay. What is your understanding of the standard subacute, Dr. Levy, what is your understanding of the standard subanesthetic dose of ketamine measured in milligrams per kilogram per hour?
Less than 0.5 milligrams per kilo per hour.
Okay. And you were provided records of the amount that Dr. Hanna was giving, is that right?
That's correct.
Did you see in the records that Dr. Hanna was providing? In the records, can you tell this jury what Dr. Hanna's doses were in terms of milligrams per kilograms per hour?
I cannot recall the exact doses that Dr. Hanna was given, but I remember doing the calculations and seeing there were many multiples above the minimal doses.
If I were to represent to you that Dr. Hanna was infusing up to 23...
Sustained.
In terms of many multiples, what percentage? Are you talking like 10 times, 100 times, or what?
Sustained.
What's your recollection in terms of the multiples of dosage of ketamine compared to what you understand to be the standard dose to be?
Same objection.
Overruled on that one.
So to the best of my recollection, they were more than 100 times of the anesthetic doses.
In your career, Have you ever seen a child age 9 to 10 be exposed to this much ketamine?
Objection. Relevance.
Overruled.
I have not.
One moment. I don't have any other questions at this time, Your Honor.
Mr. Whitney?
Nothing further at this time.
Okay, ma'am, don't go anywhere. I'm going to see if the jury has any questions. And the answer is they do. Ma'am, what I'm going to do is I'm going to mute the microphone again. It's probably going to be several minutes. So just hang tight, but understand you're going to be muted.
Okay.
And more coming, is that correct?
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.
Out at McDonald's, te puedes llevar un $5 McChicken meal deal o un $6 McDouble meal deal. Así, hay algo para todos. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.